All right. It appears that both council have checked in. The cause number is 216-397-CV, and it looks like both of you have requested your 15 minutes and then the 5 rebuttal. So when you're ready, we will proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Ken Harder here on behalf of NSL, Chief Justice Livingston. Your honors, may it please the court. In this particular case, we're dealing with some principles of law that I think are very well established, but in a somewhat new context that arises in large part, I think, out of the changes in the mortgage industry. But the single issue in this case really is whether or not a single notice of default sent by a subsequent mortgage servicer operates as an abandonment of a cause of action for the foreclosure of a property sent by the previous mortgage servicer some year and a half before. And what is before the court is a situation where the folks who owned the property before my client, Mr. and Mrs. Keeley, filed a lawsuit in district court here in Tarrant County in September or so of 2008 to stop a foreclosure, citing various reasons. And in their moving papers seeking a temporary restraining order, they attached a notice of acceleration and a notice of foreclosure sale that were dated September 2008. That particular lawsuit ended up terminating against the borrowers, against the Keeleys, in favor of the mortgagee. And later on, my client acquired the property. In the meantime, there was a change of servicers, and the new servicer sent out a single notice of default in January of 2010, I believe was the time frame, saying, "Dear Mr. Keeley," it was only sent to the one borrower, not to both, "you're $63,000 behind." So the question now before the court is whether or not that one single letter constitutes an abandonment of the acceleration. And I think that the Texas case law, the Texas appellate authorities from the Supreme Court to the various courts of appeal, says that that is either not enough on its face or certainly at most there's a question of fact as to whether or not that single letter amounts to an abandonment of the cause of action. The Texas case authorities on this general issue dealing with the general principles go back to the early part of the 20th century, and I cited the cases in my brief, but basically what they do is just set out the general principles that a party with that holds an installment note, if it's in default, can accelerate the note and demand full payment of the entire amount, and then that same lender, if it so chooses, can abandon that acceleration. And so there's language in this 1924 case out of San Antonio called City National Bank that says that that by accepting partial payments without exacting any penalties, would have the effect of abandoning an acceleration. Now, before I get a little further in, I will acknowledge that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals sitting in New Orleans has kind of thrown a monkey wrench a little bit, in my view, into this area of the law and striking out its own path in the case relied upon by Nation Star called Boren and its progeny. And I will discuss that a little bit later on, but I just want to let the court know that I acknowledge that that case is there, and I would urge the court to pay particular note to the acknowledgement of that court that in making its decision in that case, it was embarking upon what it called an eerie guess, trying to guess what the Texas Supreme Court might say about the facts of that particular case. So I'll get to that in just a moment. I think what's important here is in looking at the Texas case law that there's got to be a certain type of conduct on the part of either the parties collectively or on the part of the note holder individually to have a finding that there's been an abandonment of acceleration. Interestingly, the Texas legislature, in a statute that came into effect after the facts of this case, which is Civil Practice and Remedies Code 16.038, tried to inject a little bit of clarity into this area by providing that a rescission or waiver of acceleration should be in writing with written notice and with certain sorts of requirements that have to be undertaken. Now, the legislature also said that that's not the exclusive way of rescinding an acceleration or abandoning an acceleration, which I think indicates that there's not really a change to the common law in Texas on this particular issue. But there's certainly a way for a lender to rescind an acceleration or abandon its acceleration in a very clear, precise way that's in keeping with the directives of the Texas legislature. And, of course, that wasn't done in this case. There was no written waiver of acceleration that was made by any of the lenders to the borrowers in this case, and certainly not within the 4 years of the acceleration. So I think looking at the facts of the Texas cases and looking at the facts of the Bourne case are very important, because I think that gives some context and contour to what it takes for a lender to abandon acceleration. One of the cases I cited is the Kahn case, K-H-A-N, and that's a relatively recent case, and that was a case where the trial court granted a summary judgment in favor of the borrower, finding that there was a breach of the statute of limitations and finding as a matter of law that there was not an abandonment of the acceleration. And in the Kahn case, Mr. Kahn had bought the note from the previous holder. It had gone through a couple of hands, ended up in his hand, and it was kind of an inside deal where Kahn and the borrower kind of got together, and the borrower got Mr. Kahn to buy the note and agree to allow the note essentially to be reinstated. And so the Court of Appeals in that case said, well, at minimum, there's a question of fact as to whether or not the acceleration really was abandoned, given the facts of this particular case where Mr. Kahn evidently made at least a verbal agreement with the borrower that, hey, we're going to go ahead and restore the note to its previous circumstances. We have another case where acceleration was found to be abandoned, and that's the Santibanez case, Santibanez versus Saxon, which is cited in the brief. And that's a case where the court held that there was an abandonment of acceleration, but in that particular case, there were a number of payments that had been accepted by the borrower after the lender had accelerated the note. So we're going back to the language from the case in 1924, and language which was actually, again, recited by the Supreme Court in the Holy Cross case, which everybody, I think, before the court has cited, talking about the lender basically accepting payments or taking any other action without exacting remedies, which indicates their desire to go ahead and abandon an acceleration. Another case which shows where there was an abandonment of acceleration is the one called Beerdyk, B-I-E-D-R-Y-C-K. I'm probably butchering the gentleman's name. But again, this was a case where the court found that there was an abandonment of acceleration. There were serial Rule 736 filings in the non-suits. There was money accepted in payments by the bank from the borrower after the initial accelerations. And so in those particular case, in that particular case, you've got conduct on the part of both parties that indicates there was an agreement by both parties to set aside the acceleration, and the bank obviously waived its acceleration because it went ahead and accepted these payments. There were other cases that I cited where the courts did find that there was not an abandonment of acceleration. And there's a couple of recent cases. There's the Hardy case and the Berg case. And in both of those cases, there were circumstances where there were actually written agreements in the form of like modifications or trial payment type of arrangements where the parties agreed that pending completion of the trial period or so forth, any payments would not be considered to be an abandonment of acceleration, and the courts there found that there was in fact no acceleration. Now the Bourne case is somewhat similar to some of these others, but it's a little different in one respect, I guess. It's somewhat similar in that in the Bourne case there were serial 736 filings. There were four of them. So the bank would file a Rule 736. The borrower would file a quiet title suit. The 736 would be dismissed. And then the quiet title suit was dismissed. And then there'd be another acceleration, another Rule 736, another quiet title suit. And this pattern repeated itself four times. And on the fourth occasion is when the borrower said, well, wait a second, we think the cause of action has become barred by the statute of limitations. And what the Fifth Circuit said in this case was that U.S. Bank, who was the mortgagee, by virtue of the serial filings of both the 736s and the serial filings of the notice of default and the accelerations, abandoned their initial acceleration. I think it's arguable that Boren is not inconsistent with the Texas authorities, except to this one extent. If Boren is read to mean that a single notice of acceleration sent by a subsequent servicer amounts to an abandonment of the cause of action for foreclosure, I think that is a stretch, at least to say that that is the case as a matter of law. I think there could be a case to be made that a fact issue is raised and that a judge or a jury would have to hear the evidence about what was on the mind of the mortgagee at the time it sent that one notice, if anything. I don't want to be too charitable. But certainly as a matter of law, can we say conclusively under those circumstances that a single notice of that nature is enough to trigger the abandonment or enough to abandon the triggering of the cause of action? Now, the bank in their brief looks to analyze these issues to some degree under the principles of waiver. And I think waiver and abandonment are two ways of talking about the identical issue. I don't think there's really any change in the way that you would analyze it, whether you do it talking about waiver or you talk about abandoning an acceleration. But in looking at some recent Texas Supreme Court case law on the issue of waiver, I find a case called Jernigan versus Langley, which is at 111 Southwest 3rd, 153. And at pages 156 and 157, the court goes through, I think, the traditional elements of what is waiver. And it says waiver is defined as an intentional relinquishment of a known right or intentional conduct inconsistent with claiming the right, that it's largely a matter of intent, and for implied waiver to be found through a party's actions, intent must be clearly demonstrated by surrounding facts and circumstances. And there can be no waiver of a right if the person sought to be charged with waiver says or does nothing inconsistent with an intent to rely upon the right. And lastly, that waiver is ordinarily a question of fact, but when the surrounding facts and circumstances are undisputed, as in this particular case, then it becomes one of law. So when we analyze this particular case in light of those precepts set out by the Texas Supreme Court, or really just recited, I think these are well-established principles, we know that we do not have an express waiver because there was never anything sent to the borrowers that said, we hereby waive, rescind, abandon, or acceleration. So the question is whether or not there's an implied waiver, and can you say by virtue of their conduct in sending that one single notice of default that that implies to a known implies to an intent to actually walk away from that. And then I think when you overlay that with the fact that you have a new servicer who may or may not be aware of what had gone on before, and there's no evidence to indicate that they did, you can't really say that they knew what they were walking away from. So with that, Your Honors, I'll give back the balance of this portion of my time. I know it's
Hartley,
not much.
I have a question or two for you, please.
Yes, sir.
You seem to take it as a matter of established fact in this case that there was a proper acceleration.
Yes, Your Honor.
On the other hand, your opponents seem to believe that there was a missing step in the two-step process of acceleration required under Texas law. How do you get past the two-step requirement?
Well, Your Honor, there is a two-step requirement. In this particular case, what we had to put before both the trial court and this court was the notice of acceleration, and this is in our appendix at Exhibit 2, and the notice of trustee sale. I think that it would strain credulity to think that the folks that were representing the mortgagee at the time, Barrett Daffin, the firm out of Dallas, would have sent the notice of acceleration and posted the sale without having first sent the notice of default.
All right, let me stop you there a
minute.
Yes, sir. The letter you're talking about is dated September 15, 2008, isn't it?
That's correct.
And that letter says mortgagee has elected to accelerate the maturity of the debt. Now, there's nothing in this letter that says that gives notice that the mortgagee has a right of acceleration that can be accelerated in the future. Rather, it just says we accelerate. So you're saying, well, we got a good law firm here, so they probably sent a notice prior to the time that they sent this September 15th letter. But there's no letter in the record of any prior communication about acceleration between anybody, the Barrett Daffin law firm, or any other person representing the then holder of the note, who was Countywide Home Loans, Inc.
All right, Countrywide Home Loans, Inc., yes. Yes, what's in the record is what is in the record, Your Honors. And I would submit that if the I just think that it would strain credulity to think that the acceleration with the notice of foreclosure would go out absent there having been a notice of intent to accelerate. And I acknowledge that that one item is missing in the record, but I think that it's not a leap to say that in this particular case that there is an acceleration, there's a notice of sale, because they did in fact post the sale. And with the posting of the sale accompanied by the actual acceleration, I think that certainly a finder of fact could find, based upon that, that there had been a notice of intent to accelerate sent before that. Otherwise, the bank is engaging in what would plainly be an illegal and improper foreclosure.
And does that create a fact question?
I think it would, given the fact that the bank seems to contest whether or not there was an accrual of the cause of action.
Is it your position that the subsequent letter dated January 27th, 2010, that is the letter from the Bank of America, is it your position that you're piecing together the notice of September 15, 2008 and the letter of January 27, 2010?
No, sir. They're completely separate events.
You think that it's your position then that whenever you're switching holders of a note and you have one holder of a note at a previous time in 2008 writing a letter, dealing with acceleration, dealing with debt due, dealing with the status of payments, and then a subsequent letter still from a holder of the note that is treating the position between the maker and the holder as being one where there can be a cure by simply making a partial payment, that you're saying those are disconnected and not connected because it's the same borrower and the same note that you're talking about.
Yeah, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that they're disconnected to this degree. The September 2008 letters and notices were one event which triggered the cause of action that the holder of the note had to go ahead and conduct a foreclosure. So then the question is whether or not this January 27, 2010 letter by itself is a sufficient indicia of the intent of the holder at that time, Bank of America, to abandon the earlier acceleration. And it's my position, Your Honor, that any time after September 2008, given the fact that the temporary injunction that had been in place in the Keeley case had gone away, that they could have gone ahead and posted the property for foreclosure again.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm sorry to ask you those after your time's up.
Oh, not at all, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Harder. Mr. Janis?
May it please the court. I'm Darren Janis, representing NationStar Mortgage in this appeal, and I'd like to begin by addressing the questions that Justice Meyer asked. The first one being about whether there was evidence of an effective acceleration in 2008. And I think, Justice Meyer, you've really hit the nail on the head with that, which is that in the Holy Cross case, the Texas Supreme Court was very clear that it is a two-step process. There must be notice of intent to accelerate and notice of acceleration, and both of those notices must be clear and unequivocal. Here, there is notice of acceleration in 2008. That was the September 15, 2008 notice of acceleration, but there is no evidence in the record of a prior notice of intent to accelerate. And so while there's some evidence that there was at least an attempt to accelerate the loan in 2008, we're missing that first step, which is essential for there to be an effective acceleration. And I'm not going to be naive and stand here and say that every attempt to accelerate is effective. Mistakes can be made. A notice of acceleration can go out without there being a prior notice of intent to accelerate. We don't know if that's what happened here simply because NSL did not provide any evidence of a notice of intent to accelerate. And it was their burden to prove that. As the party raising the claim of limitations, they had a burden to show, first, that the loan had been effectively accelerated under Holy Cross, and second, that acceleration was not abandoned. I do add a little bit of a caution, though, with regard to that issue. I would say we raised that issue somewhat reluctantly, and the reason I say that is because the issue raised by the appellant here about whether a notice of default and intent to accelerate is sufficient to constitute an abandonment as a matter of law is a very important issue. It's one that comes up very often in these mortgage cases. The Fifth Circuit has answered that question and said that it is an abandonment as a matter of law, and they did that in the Boren case. But this is the first court that has been asked to weigh in on that issue. And so that is an issue of first impression. And so the caution that I'm trying to express here is that I hope that the court won't ignore that important issue about whether there is an abandonment as a matter of law simply because the appellant here failed to provide evidence of an essential element of their claim. I think that the fact that there was that missing evidence is a reason to still affirm the district court's judgment, even if this court disagrees with us about the abandonment issue. So our position is that no matter what, the judgment should be affirmed, but we hope that the court will address, first of all, the abandonment issue, and if it feels that it needs to address the lack of evidence of an effective acceleration, that it do that also. I hope that that's clear.
If the judgment can be affirmed because of the lack of the two-step acceleration, then isn't the writing on the acceleration born issue dicta?
It could be construed that way, but I think that it's we need to hear what a state court of appeals has to say on the abandonment issue. And so I understand your question, and I think you're probably right, Justice Walker, that it runs the risk of making the abandonment issue dicta. But I don't think that it necessarily has to be, because I think that the court could, just assuming arguendo that there was an effective acceleration, could address the abandonment issue in that way. The other question, Justice Meyer, that you asked was about the subsequent servicer being the one that sent the notice of default and intent to accelerate after a different servicer had sent the notice of acceleration. And the answer to that is it doesn't matter. These mortgages change hands all the time. In this case in particular, the servicer that sent the in 2008 was Countrywide. They got acquired, as everyone knows, by Bank of America. That's common public knowledge. And the servicer that sent the notice of default and intent to accelerate in 2010 was BAC, which was part of the Bank of America family. But even though there's that relationship there, that's not necessary, because the elements of waiver are, first, that there's an existing right, second, that there's actual knowledge of that right, and third, that there's either an express relinquishment of the right or intentional conduct that's inconsistent with the exercise of that right. The second element is the key. And that is what I hear appellant arguing is that the subsequent servicer has to know that the loan had been accelerated. But that's not what the second element says. It says that there has to be knowledge of the existence of a right. Here, the right is the right to demand immediate payment in full of the loan. And certainly, BAC had knowledge that it could demand the immediate payment of the entire debt by accelerating the loan. So they had the requisite knowledge under the elements of waiver, and by sending a notice of default and intent to accelerate, which said you need to pay just the past due amount, not the entire debt, but just the past due amount, and you have 30 days to do it, or we will accelerate the loan, that is conduct that is intentional, and it's clearly inconsistent with the exercise of a right to demand immediate payment of the entire debt. In fact, I don't know how it could be any more inconsistent with the exercise of the acceleration right, because it goes completely contrary to everything that acceleration stands for, which is a demand for immediate payment of the entire debt. A notice of default and intent to accelerate does the complete opposite. It demands less than the entire debt, and it gives the borrower a period of time in which to pay that, so it's not a demand for immediate payment. And that takes me really to, I guess, three what I would call important foundational concepts about acceleration that are, I say important because they really do lay the foundation for why the Fifth Circuit in Boren found that the notice of default was a unequivocal manifestation of an intent to abandon the acceleration. The first of those is that acceleration literally changes the maturity date of the loan. When the loan is originated, the maturity date's usually about 30 years out. Maybe it's 15, it depends on the loan. But it's sometime in the future. When a lender accelerates the loan, what they're actually doing is they are moving that maturity date from the future to the present, and demanding immediate payment right now of all the entire debt that is still owed on the loan. Okay, so that is discussed in specifically in the General Motors Acceptance Corp. versus Uresti, which we cited in our brief. And I'll quote from the court in that case. They said, acceleration is a change in the date of maturity from the future to the present. Pure and simple. The second foundational concept is that we're talking about abandonment, but the courts have said that that's really framed in terms of waiver, and that's why we as counsel talked about, they're really one and the same. And in the Kahn case, the First District Court of Appeals explained that those terms are used interchangeably by the courts, but in the Holy Cross case, the Supreme Court decided to use the terminology abandonment of acceleration. And so that, since the Holy Cross case, that's the more common term that's used, but it's still couched in terms of waiver and the principles that govern waiver. And then the third foundational concept, which I've already covered, I think, to some extent, is that waiver can be either express or implied. An express waiver is an express statement that you're relinquishing the right. And then the implied waiver is the intentional conduct that's inconsistent with the exercise of that right. Council mentioned the statute that was passed recently, Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Section 16.038. I would just note very quickly that that statute really is inapplicable to this case because it was enacted after January 2010 when the abandonment of acceleration occurred. I would point out, though, that even if it did apply, that statute does not prescribe a specific form for the notice, what we would call a notice of rescission or waiver. What it does say is that rescission of waiver of acceleration is effective if made by a written notice of a rescission or waiver. It's very general. It has to be in writing, and it has to express or communicate to the borrower that the acceleration is being rescinded or waived. I would argue that a notice of default and intent to accelerate, though it doesn't use the terms rescission or waiver, does just that. So arguably, even if the statute did apply, the notice of default would have fallen under it, and we wouldn't even have to get into the common law. But we are in the common law, don't get me wrong, because the statute did not apply, and an acceleration can be waived or abandoned by actions that are inconsistent with acceleration. I'll also briefly mention, because counsel brought it up, about the notice in December or January 2010 only being sent to Patrick Keeley, that there was not a notice in the record that was also sent to Ms. Keeley. 2 points on that. First of all, the deed of trust has this to say about notice. It says, notice, and I'm quoting, and this is at page 248 of the clerk's record at section 15 of the deed of trust, and it says, notice to any one borrower shall constitute notice to all borrowers, unless applicable law expressly requires otherwise. Well, the property code, section 51.002D, which is the provision that requires a notice of default and intent to accelerate, only requires that, and I quote again, the mortgage servicer of the debt serve a debtor in default under the deed of trust. It does not require notice to everyone that signed the deed of trust. It requires notice to the debtor. Well, in this case, on the note, Patrick Keeley was the only one that signed it. And that was on pages 70 and 71 of the clerk's record. He was the only borrower on this loan. Miss Keeley signed the deed of trust because she was also an owner of the property, and she needed to consent to there being a lien placed on the property, but she herself was not a borrower on this. She was not a debtor. She was not obligated to pay the debt. Only Patrick Keeley was a debtor. So not only was he the only debtor, and the statute only requires notice to go to the debtor, but the deed of trust says notice to one is notice to all, and it's explicit about that. And with that, Your Honors, unless if you have any further questions, I'll see the podium.
I have a question.
Yes.
There's no dispute that the time frames that we're talking about in terms of action taken by the holder of the note is the September 15, 2008 letter, and the second one being the January 27, 2010 letter. Do you agree with me that those letters frame the bookends of what we're talking about here?
I do.
And what's your position as to the effect of the January 27, 2010 letter as regards the options that are there for the debtor after that letter was received?
I believe the options that the debtor has is that they can pay the past due amount and bring the loan current and thereby cure their default. If they do not, then the lender would have the right to accelerate, or in this case, reaccelerate the loan and proceed with a foreclosure. But the borrower certainly would have the right to cure their default and then continue making their payments under the original terms of the loan.
Well, the letter of January 27, 2010, has in bold type that the mortgage payments will be accelerated. Now, isn't that consistent with taking the position that there hasn't already been an acceleration?
I would say that it's consistent with the position that the loan is not currently accelerated, that there has been an abandonment of any prior acceleration.
And therefore, what's impact is that on the four-year statute of limitations? In other words, we're here dealing with 2008 and 2010. That's just 2 years apart. It's not 4 years apart.
Right. And so what the courts have said about that is that if an acceleration is abandoned within the four-year period under the limitation statute, that it restores the contract to its original terms and it effectively restarts everything once the loan is reaccelerated. So the statute of limitations, I guess the best way to describe it is that it went away when the acceleration was abandoned and it did not start again. There was a new 4 year period that started, I believe, in March of 2014. Yes. In March 7th, 2014, when another notice of acceleration was sent to the Keeleys.
All right. So there's really three different time frames. It's 2008, 2010, and 2014.
Correct.
All right. Thank you for answering my question.
You're welcome. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Janis. Mr. Harder.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of points I'd like to make. I'd like to be brief here at this point. The first thing just to stress is that there are no Texas state authorities that I could find that even cite Bourne, much less rely on it in any way. Bourne has not been a factor in any Texas appellate authority. But I think to Justice Walker's concern that Your Honor expressed earlier, if the court were to find that there's not adequate evidence of an acceleration in 2008, it probably would not be prudent or proper for the court to write on the applicability of Boren or the effect of the 2010 letter, because that wouldn't be necessary to the resolution of the case. And then I think it would be wiser to leave that question to a later date when the record is maybe more fully developed on that one particular point. Lastly, I think to the concerns that Justice Meyer has been expressing, most of these cases will say that the question of waiver or abandonment is generally a question of fact. Obviously, if the evidence is at a certain point where there can't be a reasonable dispute as to the meaning of that particular evidence, it becomes a question of law. I would urge the court that given the circumstances of this case, that a single letter sent by a new servicer that doesn't expressly abandon the previous acceleration gives rise at minimum to a question of fact as to whether or not that letter constitutes an actual abandonment of the acceleration. And so therefore it would be appropriate to remand the case back to the trial court for a trial where that issue could be fully vetted and put before the trier of fact. Okay, with that, I'll yield back my time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Harder. Mr. Janis, we appreciate all your briefing in this matter as well as your arguments today. Your case is now submitted, and we will adjourn court.